It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Hello there, film lovers, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which we'll update someday at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Kobe Slagle's out this week, so it's just you and me. We're going to dip into the archives quite a bit in this week's show, looking back at some fun chats here on the show. The music you're hearing under me is the end credits to Back to the Future, of course, originally done by Alan Silvestri. This is part of a collection called 1985 at the Movies, done by the Varese Sarabande Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Newman. So I'll be sprinkling these throughout the show today. Well, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, it's just you and me, so let's life has a way of getting in the way of things. So let's at least mention opening in theaters this week is Youth, which is the a story about the passion of life set in a retirement facility starring Michael Caine, Harvey Keitel, Rachel Weisz, Jane Fonda, and Paul Dano. The Danish Girl with Academy Award winner Eddie Redmayne, and it's a love story based on one of the first transgender pioneers, finally opening in theaters. And, of course, In the Heart of the Sea, Ron Howard's film about Moby Dick that is not named Moby Dick. My daughter and I had a chat about why it's not called Moby Dick, so there is that. And also opening in theaters very soon, Carol with Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. All right. Also a note, new on DVD and Blu-ray this week, Minions, which I know they're trying to push for best animated feature. Entertaining, not necessary. You know, enjoy the Minions in of course, Despicable Me 1 and 2. And they're short films. Does it need to have a 90-minute film? No, but it's amusing enough and harmless enough that I guess it could be a lot worse. Nice vocal work by Sandra Bullock and John Hamm as well. Yeah, I guess you could do a lot worse out there. Also new on DVD and Blu-ray is Knock Knock, the Eli Roth thriller starring Keanu Reeves. It's a remake of a 70s film that not that many people know about two teenage girls that stop whose car breaks down, and they stop at the home of a happily married family man, Keanu Reeves, and of course it takes a drastic turn, but not quite what you think. So that is anyway. That's out there on DVD as well. Okay, we're going to raise a glass and pay tribute to dead people we like, because we don't have time for dead people we don't like. Italian actor Gabrielle Ferzetti, who best known in my world as the railroad baron Morton in Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, of course did thousands of films and TV in Italy. But here in the States, probably best known for that. He also played Draco in the James Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Was also in films like The Confession, the Liz and Dick movie Divorce His, Divorce Hers. He played Hans in The Night Porter, as well as appearing in films like A Matter of Time and Encounters in the Deep. And, of course, also tipping the hat to actor Robert Loggia, who died on December 4th at the age of 85. Still working. Had according to his IMDb page, had two films completed and was in post-production for another one. Apparently, there's going to be a 12 Angry Men and Women, and he was a part of that. Of course, in my house, and for a lot of people, best known as the boss in Big. Yes, that's the older gentleman dancing with Tom Hanks. Received an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor for Jagged Edge. Again, working constantly. A lot of the stuff, especially in later years, I have no clue about. But, hey, as long as the check's clear. I know my friend Melissa Davis will appreciate it. He was in Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie. Films like, my goodness, Smilla's Sense of Snow, Lost Highway, of course. He played General Gray in Independence Day. Was Sylvester Stallone's foil in Over the Top. Of course, he was in Pritzi's Honor. Probably the first thing I got to really remember him, besides being that guy, was in Scarface as Frank Lopez. Of course, plays Herb Moskowitz in Blake Edwards' S.O.B. And a lot of TV. A lot of TV and a lot of movies in the 60s and 70s. Also played Faustino Morales in the god-awful biopic Che. Forgot he played Joseph in The Greatest Story Ever Told. He was one of those that guys who you recognize and then you go back to earlier work and didn't realize he was in it. Especially films like 1963's Cattle Queen and 1957's The Garment Jungle. So salute to both of you gentlemen. All right, I want to share another piece of music with you, and then we'll go into the archives. This is a tune that was originally, the music was done by Jerry Goldsmith. This is from the collection 1985 at the Movies, and it's from the Ridley Scott film Legend, not the Tom Hardy Craze Brother film, which is should be out very, very soon.
Come down, sparrow, sing me good morning. Rise up, sun, like the arch of the sky. Living river, turn light to diamonds. When I look in my true love's eyes, young as any spring, his eyes almost sing.
That was Suzanne Walters on the vocals, music by Jerry Goldsmith, lyrics by John Bettis. That is Reunited from the 1985 Ridley Scott sci-fi film Legend. Yes, the one with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry. This is from a collection called 1985 at the Movies, featuring the Very Saraband Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Newman.
Hi, this is Rich Coase, and I just wanted you to know that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. It could have been in Berwyn, but it isn't. Well, hello there. I'm Sven Gulli from MeTV, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. If there's an Indian Annapolis, it means that he's like, you know, a military-type person from Native America. Hello there. This is Kerwin, the prehistoric rubber chicken from the Sven Gulli show on MeTV, and I wanted to remind you that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis, which is like Indian no place. Well, hello there. My name is Zamati Tombstone from the Sven Gulli program on MeTV, and I wanted to advise you that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. I flunked sociology, so good luck.
Thank you.
That's right. That's the suite from A View to a Kill, music by John Barry, arranged by Nick Rain, and flute by Sarah Anden. This is from the 1985 at the Movies Collection, the Vera Sarabande Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Newman. Where else on Film Sociology could you hear a version of a classical version of A View to a Kill, followed by a Svengoolie medley? Special thanks to Rich and company for that's just one of my favorite interviews with Rich Coase, which you're going to hear in a little bit. Just a reminder, Saturday nights at 10 on MeTV, 13.3, I think, if you're in Indianapolis. I have channel 510, living way out in the sticks. I love the sticks, don't worry. But anyway, Svengoolie is on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock, and this Saturday night they are showing The Mole People. This is grab a few drinks and enjoy this. This is a fun, bad film to enjoy. So we are going to go into the archives, and here is my epic chat with Rich Coase. You grew up in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I've pretty much spent my whole life here in Chicago, my whole life and even my whole career. I was born in Chicago, and about 4 years after that, we moved to some suburbs of Chicago.
Such as?
Around the Morton Grove Niles area.
As a kid, what horror show host did you watch?
I barely got in on one of the originals. I was very young, but I remember seeing at some relatives' houses when we were there late, Marvin, Terry Bennett, who hosted Chicago's Shock Theater. Back then, of course, that was the name. Shock was the name of the Universal movie package that was released all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Vampyra was first running her stuff out in L.A. And in Chicago, it happened to go to WBKB-TV, where Terry Bennett worked, and he became Marvin, the sort of beatnik-type ghoul host.
That laid the foundation for Jerry G. Bishop?
Not so much, because I think Jerry was already out of town by then and working his way through radio in various cities, radio and TV.
How old were you when you started watching Jerry?
I was actually just about to enter college.
And what were your impressions of watching Jerry work on television?
Well, first of all, I'd been a fan of his anyway from his radio work. He'd been on the air doing morning radio and such for many years already before he even hit that, and I was a fan of his, so I, you know, was tuning in just because I heard that he was doing some funny shtick in between things as just a voiceover announcer for the horror movies on Friday night. And as it was developing along, you know, I enjoyed the character that he was portraying as well, and how he was kind of, you know, positioning himself between the various segments of the movie.
Did he ever tell you how he developed the character?
He kind of was taking a tip from the famous Ernie Anderson, Goulardi, who was on opposite him on TV when he was working in Cleveland. But Goulardi was another sort of beatnik-type character. And Jerry decided to kind of update that and make it a sort of hippie ghoul. And so he kind of got the nod from that. And then he always said that his Svengoolie accent was kind of Bela Lugosi crossed with Yiddish.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, what was even funnier was he always described my accent as a combination of Bela Lugosi and Lawrence Welk.
So Berwyn really loves you.
I guess so, yeah. Much closer ties than I thought.
Well, it's interesting because looking back, because I asked the question I had earlier about the foundation for Jerry is because of the hippie persona, and then you mentioned the beatnik persona, it was interesting as a youngster with my local horror show host. I grew up in Michigan, and ours was Sir Graves Gasly out of Detroit. Mm-hmm. Is on the surface, it was scary looking, but then I realized, looking back, he did a segment in drag. He did a segment German. He would paint a face on his chin and be filmed upside down. And he showed kids pictures. And in your case, looking at the early pictures, by the way, there's somebody here at work who grew up in Elkhart, and she wanted me to tell you, you scared her when she was a little kid.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few people.
You're
here
right.
And there.
but the fact is, maybe the exterior was scary, but you know, you're cracking jokes the entire time. And I thought, especially with Jerry's, it's a hippie. He's not a vampire or a ghoul or a zombie. It's a hippie that delivers one-liners.
Right, exactly. I think part of it is just that the characters, I always said, you know, there have always been people who said, you should try to act more scary. And I've often said, well, the only people who will be scared by that are, you know, kids under the age of five. It's not very effective. If you're trying to act scary and, you know, people are watching, they're going to go, oh, come on. Whereas making the character kind of comic relief to the horror is what seems to be what works. And for the most part, that's what most of the very successful hosts have done, whether it be tongue-in-cheek or, you know, just blatant, you know, goofballs like myself.
What did you think the first time you saw Count Floyd on SCTV?
I thought he was hilarious. It was funny because I had actually seen Joe Flaherty, who played Count Floyd, live at Second City while he was in his tenure here in Chicago. It was right after I got out of high school, in fact. And I thought he was a very funny guy to begin with. But then when I saw that, I thought it was really hilarious. And one of the things that somebody brought up is, you know, he obviously was still doing Second City here in town. He hadn't gone back up to Canada during the time that Jerry was doing his Svengoolie stuff here. So it seems like, you know, a little bit of that might have been, you know, added into his whole Count Floyd persona. The idea of, you know, running movies that maybe weren't quite, you know, what you would want to run during the time. Because Jerry had a few that were like, wait a minute, this isn't really a horror movie. And, yeah, I thought Count Floyd was very, very funny.
Now, I know you started sending jokes to Jerry. What do you remember the first one he ever used?
I think it was something like, you'll love this one.
Okay.
What do you call a grave in Russia?
A what?
A communist plot.
Oh. You know what? I think that's being used on Fox News today, so it's all right.
Well, yes, it's right up their alley there. Yeah, so at first I was just sending him random jokes that I thought he could use because he was, you know, actually soliciting them from viewers. And then I, you know, let him know a little bit about what I was doing, that I was a broadcasting student. And I actually wrote something that was more specific for him. And he started to kind of request specific things, like, can you do a parody of such and such commercial or something like that. So it got into more long-form things than just separate jokes.
And how long before he invited you into the studio to work?
I would say it was, at the most, about a year, probably a little less than that. And he had me come in, and I ended up going in there, and he'd say, hey, can you do this voice for me off camera? And, you know, I did some artwork that he needed for the show. One of the guys working there then would jokingly refer to me as Jerry's art director. And he had me going with him and doing his public appearances with him, his various characters and such. And, you know, and then it became pretty much he was trying to work it out so that I would have a full-time job at Channel 32. But before that happened, his Svengoolie show was canceled. So,
well, before the birth of Son, what did your parents hope you would be doing at this time?
You know, I don't know that they had any specific direction that they were hoping I would go in. My dad worked in sheet metal and ventilation, and I think he pretty much knew that I wasn't planning to go in that direction. They knew that I liked radio, and I think they kind of thought that I would go in that direction in broadcasting, but I don't know that they expected me to go into television as well.
Well, how did Son of Svengoolie come about?
Basically, what happened was there was a time in between when I became Son of Svengoolie and when Jerry stopped being Svengoolie that one of the guys that was a friend of Jerry's at one of the local stations had called him and said, you know, you should just do Svengoolie just as a summer fill-in thing for us here. And they talked about it a little bit, and Jerry was like, well, I don't know that I want to dress up in this stuff again. And he said, you know what? He said to me, why don't you could be like Son of Svengoolie, and then you and I can write and, you know, produce the thing together. And I was like, sure, that'd be cool. And then we talked about it, kicked it around, had some false starts on it, and nothing ever really happened with it. And then a couple years down the road, when Jerry was going to head out to San Diego to do radio and TV there, he said, well, you know, what are you planning on doing now? Because somebody else I had been working with, Dick Orkin, do you know him?
I've heard the name.
Famous radio guy who did radio commercials and did a lot of famous modern radio serials like Chicken Man.
Oh, right.
Tooth Fairy.
Yeah.
I'd been working with him, and he went off to L.A., And now Jerry was leaving, and he said, well, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to pitch some local station on a TV show and see if I can make any inroads there. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, you have my blessing. And so he kind of handed that off to me, and which was very flattering that he would, you know, take the character that he had created and kind of, you know, turned it over to me more or less.
Now, for those who don't go on YouTube, what was the, besides the look, what was the biggest difference between Jerry's character and yours?
Geez, let's see. Well, Jerry used to play the guitar and sing, and I cannot play the guitar well enough to do that.
We thank you for that.
Yes, yeah, anytime. Believe me, you wouldn't want to sit through that. But basically, it's the same type of character, you know, kind of mm-hmm. wisecracking. And I think Jerry's character, I don't know how to put this better, was a little more aggressive than mine. And I think that, you know, Sven is more, the one that I'm doing is more the Jack Benny character who is set upon by the other characters and such around him. Whereas Jerry was more, you know, the wise guy who was, you know, dealing with the others or something.
And, yeah, so you're the chicken butt of the jokes.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
Thank you. And when did the chickens your creation, the flying chickens?
Oh, no, that went back to Jerry.
Okay.
The famous old vaudeville prop of a rubber chicken.
Right.
He decided that whenever he would do some bad joke, which was pretty often, he would be pelted with those rather than tomatoes or something like that, or bricks, which would not have been pleasant.
Or the giant hook.
The giant hook, yes. That would have been much more difficult to have one of the stagehands maneuvering all the time. You got to also spread the fun to people, because if there's one thing people always request, is can I come and throw chickens at you?
Gee, I don't know what you're talking about. I think I'm at the bottom of the scroll right now.
I see.
My first viewing of you, of course, was syndicated on Channel 50 in Detroit, and this was in the early 80s. How did the syndication come about?
Well, after there had been various shows that had run back and forth, they had tried to run The Ghoul from one of the stations that was owned by, which company was it at the time? Kaiser, I guess, Kaiser Broadcasting. And they actually bumped Jerry Svengoolie off so that they could run The Ghoul. And he was not well accepted in Chicago because compared to Jerry's character, this was, you know, an interloper. And he didn't make any friends because we first started out saying something like, yeah, we got rid of that bum Svengoolie.
Yeah,
nice work.
Nice.
But based on that and the fact that there was a guy in power at our Chicago station who was running all the field stations, there were field stations by then.
Right.
He really believed in what I was doing, and he wanted to get it on the other channels. And the funny thing was that we ended up on five different channels in different cities, but a lot of the stations, for some reason, felt that this was being forced on them, so they would not promote it, and you know, they would do nothing to help us out. And now, years later, I hear from people who watched me in the various cities, and they were like, oh, yeah, everybody used to watch that. And I had no idea that there was an audience watching me back then. And they say, oh, you went to Chicago after this. And I said, no, actually, I was in Chicago the whole time. And we would customize the opens and closes, especially, so that it would look like, you know, it was something, you know, with jokes playing off that specific city. It was kind of a pain because we'd have to reshoot every open and every close for each city, mm-hmm. and I'd have to rewrite it so that I would get in local jokes.
What were the other cities?
We were in San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago.
I remember because you made a crack on Bill Kennedy, who hosted the local show, the
right,
local movie
sure.
show in the afternoon. And I remember calling Channel 50 and asking about you, and they told me that you were based out of Chicago, and I didn't believe them.
No,
because you mentioned Bill Kennedy. How did you know? Of course you know. So,
yeah. Well, it was funny because when we were going to do it, I asked each one of the stations, can you just send me a bunch of people, like a weatherman that I can make fun of, you know, various locations in the city, sports teams. And out of the stations, a couple of them sent really detailed stuff, and the rest were like, yeah, never mind.
Okay, I have to ask, how was Detroit's treatment of you?
Detroit was fairly weak. Sorry. They sent, like, just a little bit of information and a Detroit Pistons basketball jersey.
You still have it?
I believe I gave it to one of my brothers after the show was over.
How long did this last, the syndication?
It varied in the cities from like about 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And a lot of that was because they just, you know, they didn't promote it, and they felt like it was not, you know, it was not something they wanted to do. It wasn't their production. At one point, we actually went to Philadelphia and shot on their set. They built a whole set just for me to shoot on.
Wow.
And everybody there, for the most part, was not cooperative. You know, we were doing different bits and stuff. We ran a bit that was pretty famous that we did, Mr. Robber's Neighborhood.
Right.
Where, you know, I'm supposed to be like a Fred Rogers as a criminal who breaks into people's homes. That's why he changes his shoes so they can't hear him.
Right.
And he was talking about how he had a good sharp knife to do something with. And one of the engineers there goes, oh, that's nice, teaching kids to use knives.
Wow, this coming from Philly fans that cheer when Santa Claus get taken off on a stretcher at Eagles games.
Well, what can I tell you? So it was an uphill battle in most of those places, and I think that's why it didn't last, especially in a couple of those cities.
Well, from a kid's standpoint, it felt like it was on longer, and I mean that as a compliment. And I think also because of the test of time, and there's no internet, and it was you had to be there for that time, unless you had a VHS or Betamax. You had to be there for that time to see the show.
Exactly. Yeah, that was it. You know, that's why I hear these people now who see the old clips and they go, wait, I remember when this was on in you know, San Francisco or whatever.
Yep.
It's quite a story. I think San Francisco was the city that we were in the longest, and that was like a full year. By then, all the others had dropped out.
Some of the other characters that you had now, was Durwood from the Jerry era, or was and you inherited him?
Yes, Durwood, the ventriloquist puppet, was from Jerry's era, and to this day, I wish he hadn't picked such a high falsetto voice, which he could do much better than I could, because I felt he should still have a similar type voice. You know, I didn't want to change the voice on it, but it's much harder for me to do. Tombstone was a character based on, really, he had a female skull named Zelda. And, again, I didn't want to do the exact same thing with that, so we created Tombstone. His name originally was Zalman T. Tombstone, Jr., and it was a playoff on the old Billy Saluga character, Raymond J. Johnson,
oh,
Jr., that was very popular
right.
at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tombstone even had his own little litany, you know, like the, he doesn't have to call me Johnson type thing, you know. But you can call me Toomey, or you could call me, and we did that at a while beginning. After all, I was like, I think people will be sick of this. Let's just drop it.
I always imagined Tombstone, it sounded like if Bob Dylan and the Kingfish had a child.
Yeah, that's pretty close, I'd
okay.
say, definitely.
Tell us about the evolution of Kerwin.
Kerwin, yeah. Well, we've had a series of different sort of puppet-like assistants doing the mail. The first was our piano player, Doug.
Right.
And he was actually a live person. but he often couldn't stay around long enough because he's in actuality a working musician who constantly has different gigs all over the place. So he couldn't wait around until we got, you know, after we did the song to do the music. We did the music bits, and then we'd have to wait to do the mail after we did several other things, and he often couldn't stay around. So we just said, well, let's try some things. And we had a bat whose voice was like a sort of processed high-tone thing.
Right.
And it was so annoying that one of the bosses in charge here actually said, I want you to get rid of it. And we had to actually do a bit where he was fired because he couldn't stand that voice. And then for a while we had a pterodactyl who was a disc jockey who was the assistant, and a dinosaur, I believe. We're very into reptiles at times.
I see.
And finally, we had a spider for a while, and because he had eight legs, he had eight different voices, and for some reason that just didn't work at all. But finally, someone from our kids' show, Green Screen Adventures, a young lady named Jessica Hope Carlton, who is very adept at building puppets, kind of as a surprise, cooperating with my director, came up with this. She used like one of those sort of alligator-type things you buy at the zoo. It's like a head on a stick, and you pull a little trigger to make it talk and move the mouth. And she combined that with the body of a rubber chicken and created Kerwin as a prehistoric rubber chicken.
Who sounds like Jerry Lewis?
Who? Yeah. Well, when I first looked at him, when they gave him to me, he had these kind of goofy eyes and funny teeth, And for some reason, it struck me that he sort of looked like very young Jerry Lewis. So that was why he got the voice. It was kind of like this.
Do you also not bring up Dean Martin around him?
No, I constantly bring up Dean Martin just to make him angry.
So speaking of Doug, how do you select the music for the shows?
You know, I've often been asked by one of my coworkers, what are you thinking? Because I'll say, you know, I want to do something, you know, this is about like flying to the moon. And he'll say, okay, and he comes up with all these songs with moon in it. And then I'll go, I know, and come up with some song that has no word moon in it. And he'll be like, wait, I don't get it. But there's some way that I can tie in certain lyrics that sound exactly like, you know, what the originals are that has something to do with the movie.
And how did you meet Doug?
Doug and I went to high school together, actually. We were in band together in high school. And we became friends and just hung around together. And when I started doing TV shows, I figured, you know, it would be great to have him help out.
What did you play?
I played trombone. It's been a long time since I played trombone, so please don't ask me to do a solo.
Oh, no, that's well, we live in the land of J.J. Johnson. We wouldn't ask you to do that.
Well, certainly, yeah.
But I also imagined you as Woody Allen in Take the Money and Run, where you played the cello, but you also had to drag the chair during the parade.
Let me tell you, being a trombone player in a parade is not fun because you're right at the front of the band, because of the slide action, they put you there, and also, when you're playing, you don't get to look down and see if there's anything dropped by the horses that were earlier in the parade. That was one of the biggest hazards. And I always thought that doing marching band out on a field was one of the most unmusical experiences ever, because you think you're doing these formations and stuff, and half the instruments turn away from the stands while they're walking in, you know, some pattern, and that means they can't hear that part of the music. So it's like you're not hearing the whole, you know, thing like you do in a concert. What's the deal?
How did Jerry and you come up with all of those sound clips?
Well, with Jerry, it was a matter of, you know, he used them in his radio stuff. Mm-hmm. And he had a huge library of sound effects and little sound bites and things that he passed a lot of on to me. And actually, it was the same thing with me because I wanted to be in radio, and I also did that. I mean, maybe it's not as common anymore, but a lot of disc jockeys used to use little, you know, these little sound bites, little, you know, cart type reactions and called, because they were on audio carts that you'd throw into the machine. And you just built up this whole library. And of course, once I started here, a lot of the guys had suggestions for things or would find something in a show or in a commercial and say, oh, you know, you should really use this. So we've got it all. It's all now computerized, obviously, like everything else. It's all digital, and it's in a little machine that we could just call up a number and hit.
How many films or how many episodes do you record in one batch?
It varies. We've done as many as 9.
Wow.
Which is, you know, we're in the studio from noon until 9 o'clock every night when we do these.
Okay.
And that's a long haul. Believe me, being in that makeup for that length of time, not pleasant. But, yeah, we've done as many as 9, and a comfortable range is usually 5, I would say.
Okay.
Because that gives us a little, you know, easier time of it. And we're not, like, under the gun like, you know, Lucy in the Candy Factory.
And when you're selecting the films, is there a pattern? I mean, you know, sci-fi, horror, monster movie, killer movie. Is there a pattern of any kind?
Well, it's not so much a pattern. My idea usually is to try to vary it somewhat, because we do get people who will often complain about the fact that we're doing you know, too many mummy movies all at once or too many Frankenstein movies. And, you know, to me it's like you're complaining about these Universal classics. Okay, whatever. But I try to vary them when I can. And also, there are certain ones that we have only a certain time window for, so we have to make sure that they can air only during, like, we've had movies that we can only run during 1 month.
Jeez.
So we have to, you know, make sure it gets in then. So a lot of times it depends on what the contractual window is, the window of time that we can fit the movies in, and, you know, what's available to us at what times.
Right off the top of your head, what are some of your favorite and least favorite films that you've shown over the years?
No, favorite ones, definitely Bride of Frankenstein. I do like House of Frankenstein. I got to run Nightmare on Elm Street, which I really enjoyed, and
wow.
Halloween, the originals. I really enjoyed those. Ones that I don't like as well, there's quite a few of those. I think I may have mentioned to you before the Midnight Movie Massacre, which was an absolutely terrible movie. There was one movie that I often cannot remember, Track of the Vampire, which is so bad and boring. It's a movie where half of it was shot in California and the other half was shot in Yugoslavia, and neither side knew what the other side was doing. And it was so bad that when I was at Channel 32, we actually intercut it with a bunch of other things. And we did one whole segment that was kind of, you know, Svens around where it had changed. And suddenly the woman, it's a scene where this woman is being chased all through the city and into the ocean by the vampire. Mm-hmm. And with my redubbing, it became the fact that she was supposed to show up for swim team practice and didn't want to. And that was the coach running after her. And at times there was like a bald lifeguard who showed up. So naturally his voice became that of Curly Howard from the Three Stooges.
Of course.
So, yeah, that was one of the really, really awful ones.
I would say, is it the quality of the film that gets it a Svens around treatment? Or have you? I think I remember once you did it with even with Night of the Living Dead.
We did separate scenes from that. A lot of times I'll lift scenes and so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the movie or, you know, ruin people's enjoyment of the actual movie itself. If it's a really bad movie, a lot of times the only way to save it is to do something like add some sound effects to it along the way.
Now, I know there was one of the writers from Mystery Science Theater 3000 grew up in Chicago. Have you made contact with any of those guys before?
No, I've never been in contact with them. I've heard from other people that, you know, they've done little shout-outs to Sven in some of their shows. That one guy said he went to some convention and dressed as me and ran into one of them, and the guy immediately said, "Hey, your son is Sven Gulli."
Okay.
They know about it. And I remember reading an article in the Chicago Tribune where they were talking to a couple of the guys, and they said, you know, we weren't the type of guys who were trying to, you know, pick up Cousin Brucey on the radio from New York or whatever like that. We were trying to watch people like Ray Rayner, who did a morning kids show here in Chicago, and Sven Gulli. So they were aware of both, and they obviously saw both Jerry Sven Gulli and my son of Sven Gulli.
Have you ever talked to any of the filmmakers or actors whose movies you've aired?
Very rarely. You know, a lot of them right now, a lot of these Universal folks,
a lot of them
not
are
around. Although I did hear, I've got a couple guys who do a great website called Terror from Beyond the Daves. And they have a blog about different horror hosts and horror-oriented things. And they both are guys who grew up watching me and are big fans. And now, especially with our national exposure, when they go to conventions, they get a lot of feedback about the show from people. They ran into Julie Adams, who was the beautiful woman in the white bathing suit in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
And she was just thrilled to hear that, you know, we show her movie on our program. The same thing with Tippi Hedren from The Birds.
Sure.
We ran at The Birds here in Chicago and won the time slot, which was just, you know, incredible. It's like Sven Gulli winning the time slot. Good grief. But she was another one who was just thrilled to hear that we were running that show on free broadcast TV since it hasn't appeared on that very much. And it's just really great to, you know, get even these secondhand things. I did meet Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger. And it turns out he's a big fan of my show. He's been watching it out in California now, and he's had a lot of very complimentary things to say about it, which is really nice. Lance Henriksen, mm-hmm. Met up with him. He's a very nice guy. It was a lot of fun and seemed to enjoy the show. We ran him in Pumpkinhead a couple
yes.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Piranha 2 as well. So.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
How often are you allowed in Berwyn?
I am allowed there any darn time I want to be there.
Do you have the key to the city yet?
They don't even need a key. I've got like a key card. Just lets me in and out. It's not a problem. Actually, yeah, it's funny because just about, I'd say, 95% of the people in Berwyn love that we do the stuff that we do about that city. And they know it's just jokes. For a while, they had a mayor who was, you know, we don't want to be the butt of Sven Gulli's jokes. And yet any time I'd show up there, he always made sure he was there to get a picture shaking my hand.
Politician.
Yes. And occasionally it's like the people who are like, oh, you know, you shouldn't make fun of our town. But the thing is, every time I've done a radio interview or TV interview, and people have asked you about Berwyn, I've always, you know, stated what I just told you and the fact that it's a really nice suburb. The people are very nice there. They're all hardworking people, and now they're trying to be, you know, a little more upscale, and they're adding more arts and things, and, you know, God bless them. It's a nice place, and it also has my favorite horror collectibles store, a place called Horror Bolts, which has a real nice stock of all sorts of things.
How did you pick Berwyn out of all the towns for the bit?
That was Jerry's doing. Back when he was trying to figure it out, he had always had, when he was in Cleveland, Goulardi, Ernie Anderson, made fun of a suburb called Parma. And when he came here, he had that in mind. And he also, at that time, Rona Martin's Laugh-In was kind of winding down, uh-huh. and they were making fun of beautiful downtown Burbank, as was Johnny Carson. And he thought, well, we need to do something like that. We can make small-town jokes about that. It'd be funny. And he was trying to decide on something, and he ended up having a sponsor that was from the Berwyn area. And when he went there, it seemed like the one street, Ogden Avenue, was all savings and loans and used car lots. And then he found out that they had the yearly parade in honor of mushrooms, the Hobie Parade. Hobie is Czech for mushroom.
Yeah.
And he decided this would be a good place to use as our city that we kind of poke fun at.
Well, it has a flow to it compared to, say, Downers Grove, Westmont, or Wheaton.
Yeah, you can't go like Cicero. It doesn't flow as well as Berwyn.
Is there a film that you've always wanted to show and have not had a chance to do yet?
Yes, Fiend Without a Face. Do you know that movie?
The French film, right?
No.
Oh no,
no.
I'm thinking of Eyes Without a Face. I'm sorry.
No. This is like a cheapo. I think it's an America International one.
Okay.
Where there's something invisible that is killing people, and they're not sure what it is. And at some point, they find a way to make them visible, and it turns out there are these brains with spinal columns that kind of like inch along. They were done with stop motion animation. And when they are fighting with them, when you shoot one, it makes a noise like a whoopee cushion, kind of, and lets loose the sort of raspberry jelly type stuff.
Is this the flying brains with the eyes? Or am I thinking of something else?
You may be confusing it with the brain from Planet Eros.
Ah, okay. All right.
But these, you would remember these right away because they're smaller brains, about the size of a human brain, but they have this sort of spinal column, and they inch along like an inchworm using that. And they can also, like, leap through the air.
Well, this is my YouTube project for the day. That's good.
All right. Yes, you'll enjoy it. Believe me.
Now, how long have you been with the U?
I have been here since 1995. At WCIU, and then as we've added more stations, my shows have gone on to the various stations, and including now our network, MeTV.
How did the MeTV deal come about?
Because of the great success we had here in town. When the U first went on, it was kind of a hybrid of what MeTV is, and also a little more modern type programming that we would manage to get. And as we went along, my boss, Neil Saban, who was like a genius, had noticed that like Nick at Night and TV Land were changing dramatically, and they weren't what they originally were supposed to be, you know, with this classic TV stuff. And he had this idea of making the MeTV station, which we did first locally here, and he felt that there was viability to that across the country since, you know, people weren't really getting that presented the way that we presented, and he managed to start the wheels in motion, and now we're in almost 80% of the country.
Cool.
And it's especially amazing that it happened in about a year's time. To have that kind of progress really says a lot for what Neil could do and what the MeTV national network can do.
I'd say you could call those other syndicated cities from the 80s and blow raspberries at them, but they're probably not there anymore or probably dead.
Well, you never know. Yeah, most of the people involved have probably moved on and are not quite around anymore or have been deposed. Knowing the nature of television, they probably lost their jobs. And
they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore.
Yes, and I'll shed a tear for them like that Indian standing alongside the highway.
For MeTV, is it strictly Universal Films?
Right now it is, yeah. We have a really nice contract with Universal, and we're actually working on an extension of that for the future that would add in even more films for us. And we're hoping that that'll happen. And this is really, you know, the first broadcast TV national exposure for these Universal horror films since many, many years ago.
Which I think is a really cool thing. I know recently there's been films like The Mole People, which I haven't seen in a long, long time. And I know the horror film with Dirk Benedict and Strother Martin. I mean, those are ones I can't even think of the last time I saw
them. You're talking
about
those.
But I think it's cool that you look for films that have not seen the light of day in a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's really an education for a lot of people because there is a generation that hasn't seen these. When we were kids, it seemed like they ran them much more on television. And now, if they run at all, they run on cable as opposed to on, you know, actual broadcast TV. So the fact that we're kind of, you know, reintroducing these to a lot of people who maybe never saw them before is really great. And it's nice to continue the Universal legacy.
And also, from an educational standpoint, I love when you do a segment based on who these actors appeared in, you know, what other films they've appeared in, what the director has worked on. You know, when my daughter saw that Bela Lugosi played the Frankenstein monster, that blew her lid a little bit, in a good way.
There are things that people really don't expect, or, you know, they don't know about connections to various things, like the people who ended up playing some other part on a TV series years later, that they had no idea that ever happened. So it's very cool to be able to, you know, make these connections for people or just remind people, you know, this guy also did this. And at times it's really a tribute to the versatility of the actors, and it's great to show that they had a wide enough range to do so many things.
You're walking IMDb, sir.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting right now, actually.
And I know also you've also been showing comedy shows, and don't listen to the internet. There's nothing wrong with that. With showing, you know, I know you've done the Three Stooges Marathon and Abbott and Costello.
Well, most of the Abbott and Costello stuff we've shown still has a horror element to it. It's not, you know, we're not just showing, you know, Hit the Ice or something like that.
Right.
Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy or you know, Frankenstein or whoever. We've thrown in a few things here and there. Yeah, well, you know, Ghost and Mr. Chicken, there's still like a horror scare element to that. If anything, you know, we've run some Marx Brothers movies, and that's mainly because I'm a big fan of the Marx Brothers. They were a big influence on me. And, you know, I love when people are like, oh, this is wrong. You should be showing only scary things. And it's like, have you noticed that a great portion of my part of the show is comedy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And we also like that, you know, you air it the same reason why dogs lick their elbows, because you can.
There you go. Exactly.
And also,
thanks for saying elbows.
Well, yes. Thank you for saying elbows, too. And also, it's really cool that the show on MeTV, you kind of become an ambassador for local horror show hosts. It's a lost art. I mean, we have Sammy Terry popping up every few months here in Indianapolis, but it's cool for you to give shout outs to cities that have had hosts, and you show other hosts and even show old photos of Jerry and you. It's a lost art, I think, for local television.
Well, with the way that television has been going now in the TV economy, most local stations do not do entertainment-type shows. They're mainly, you know, if they have budgets, they're going to do news and sports and public affairs and an occasional magazine show. But, you know, they're not going to do something that's strictly entertainment because, according to them, it doesn't generate enough money to justify, you know, the studio time and editing time and everything like that. And when we first started here locally, the people in charge of the station said, you know, well, maybe we're not going to make money on this, but it's an important part of TV and something that viewers really get an attachment to and make a connection with, and that's important to us. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, we're doing very well, and it's nice to see that people, you know, every email I get from out of town, for the most part, will mention, we haven't had anything in town like this since, you know, in the 70s with, you know, Dr. Bad Teeth or something like that. So there's always, everybody's got a horror host they watch sometime in their life, it seems.
Do you do shows strictly for MeTV, and then you do shows strictly for the U?
We have some shows that run basically, well, the ones that run on MeTV right now also run on the U as like a week delay basis. But then on the U2, we run some of the older ones that we have that we still have rights to or that are public domain. And I also do a Three Stooges show, Stoogiepalooza, that runs on Saturday nights on our Me Too channel.
So I was going to say, how often do you get to appear on TV as Rich?
Every week.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's I'm in the makeup, I'm out of the makeup. In the makeup, out of the makeup.
Well, you know, it keeps you young, maybe.
Well, I don't know about that.
Or young at heart.
Okay, I'll go with that.
So what's next for Svengoolie?
Right now, it seems like we're just continuing to go to more and more of the places in America. More and more stations are picking up the MeTV network and getting better distribution of it. And a lot of them, we started out just over the air, and now it's going to cable as well in a lot of the cities, and wider distribution in a lot of the cities. There are a lot of rumors about out on the West Coast that we're going to have more visibility out there. So I think it's just a matter of the Sven Show catching on in these various places, and then I think the next step after that is possibly starting to make public appearances all over the country, which should be fun.
Well, you know, you have a place to crash in Indianapolis, that's for sure.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is from the collection 1985 at the movies, the suite, well, part of the suite to music from the film Brazil. Of course, originally done by Michael Kamen. Why not? This is from, once again, 1985 at the movies, performed by the Varese Sarabande Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Newman. Great film, intriguing score. Michael Kamen, definitely a composer of the 80s and early 90s, if you're into that stuff. Right, Brian Hartz? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the tail end of the show. That's when real self-indulgence kicks in. You know, last week was the new season of Top Chef, and yeah, it's an excuse for me to play this, my chat with Padma.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Padma. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're hanging here in Indianapolis.
I'm good. We're just, we're sitting here drinking up some coffee. Very happy, jittery people.
Well, that's good to know. When it comes to summer, what is the first dish that you think of?
Well, you know, I think there's nothing so classic in summer as ice cream. And I'm going to show you how to dress up ice cream and make it into a fabulous dessert and give your guests a coffee all rolled into one. And the recipe is so easy, but if you don't write it down, it's on Nespresso.com. Basically, Nespresso makes these great espresso machines. Their coffee machines are renowned all over the world. And they basically have a Pixie machine, which is the one I love. It comes in a lot of colors. You pop the little capsule of coffee in. It's the best possible coffee. You make the espresso. You just take a beautiful, simple scoop of vanilla ice cream, put it in a coffee cup, pour the espresso hot over it, sprinkle some chocolate chips, and drizzle some caramel sauce. That is it. You could add nuts, you could add cinnamon, you know, you could add peanut butter chips, but that's the basic recipe. And again, if your viewers are, you know, sorry, if your listeners are driving or whatever, it's on the website. Go to Nespresso.com.
Sounds like a good movie treat as well.
It's awesome, honestly. It, you know, they have this beautiful milk machine called the Arachino, and it's basically you just plug it in and it steams up the milk and gives you that foam, just like those high-end coffee bars all across Italy and Switzerland and France. It foams everything up. It steams the milk in 1 second. It's beautiful. Actually, probably about 30 seconds. But It's so easy to do.
Well, can you tell us a little bit of what's in store for season 10 of Top Chef?
Well, we haven't filmed it yet, so there's not much I can tell you. We're in pre-production right now. I think we're just all racking our brains and figuring out how we're going to top Texas from last season. I mean, we had such an incredible, incredible season, and we're just gearing to shoot. It'll probably be on the fall, and I think we're trying to shake it up again. I think you'll see a lot of surprises. I mean, you know, Charlize Theron and Patti LaBelle were on last season, so who knows who they'll come up with this season.
Padma, we can top Texas, Indianapolis.
Sounds good to me.
So I was curious, when you see somebody cooking in a movie, do you pay extra special attention to see if they're actually doing it right?
You know, that's a great question. I do, actually. I'm a big freak about continuity because, you know, I come from theater and I've done a couple of movies, and so I can always tell when there's not continuity or when someone's phoning it in. And, like, you know that scene in Jerry Maguire where Renee Zellweger answers the door? Watch it. When they cut to his view, her necklace is tied differently.
Ah, yes. So movie-wise, who can cook?
You know what? Stanley Tucci can cook his face off. That is not, he is not playing. Everything in Big Night is very authentic.
Great
so
film.
So can Martin Scorsese. His first student film was a film about his mom's spaghetti sauce. He gave me a copy of it. It's brilliant.
And didn't she do all the cooking in that one kitchen scene in Goodfellas?
Yes. That's an incredible scene.
So anytime we're going to see you in a movie anytime soon?
I have a couple offers, but my problem is my scheduling. You know, you have to really do one thing and do it well. I haven't been in a movie since I started Top Chef 5 years ago. My last film was for the BBC. I would love to do another film. It just has to be the right one and work with the schedule, which is not always easy. I'm just thankful for my job on Top Chef at this point.
Of course. Padma, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, Matthew.
All right, you too. And there's music, or as they call it, themes, from Silverado, originally done by Bruce Broughton. This is from the 1985 at the Movies Collection, performed by the Varese Sarabande Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Newman. Well, we're just about done this week. Hopefully, Kobe and I will be back next week in full force. Get it? Because, yeah, it's opening next week. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz is spoken. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there now. We are in the midst of grown-up movie season. And hopefully we'll be talking more about those next week. So, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Good night, California. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, Michigan. Good night, Richmond. And I played it earlier. I might as well play a different version of it. What the heck? Here we go. Meeting you with a view.
sacred wine, a mystery.